other.
There's hey, I'm Terry Floyd.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the Tailgate.
Hey, sister. Know the water's sweet, but blood is thicker. Oh, if the sky comes falling down.
Thank you for coming back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foy, and despite what the introduction said, he is not Nick Osello. He is, in fact, Larkin Kemp substituting, coming in off the bench, the fresh legs, late in the third quarter when the game gets won. Larkin Kemp, how's it going, man? Thanks for joining.
Doing great. Happy Sunday. Really, only Nick Osello could somehow worm his way into an occupation of hosting a podcast that he just takes like hunting tags in the middle of and, you know, is out in the woods, not watching Notre Dame, not watching any ball at all. But great to be here. It was a great slate yesterday. Excited to get through it, and this will be fun.
So let's start by talking about the Brown Bears. We know that everybody wants to hear it, and you got the first dub under the belt, the first dub of the John Torpy era. How'd the game unfold?
I mean, it was pretty ugly. It was a pillow fight, but anytime you beat your crosstown little brother, especially early in a new staff era, just building some mojo and some moxie in the room. I actually think Brown's defense is better than people think. Charlie Cave's like fantastic, and they have a ton of depth, experience depth with Mark Witt and Trey Taylor. And I think that the best sign this week is some potential holes at the bottom of the table in the Ivy. So I think I'm going to start the marching band around the road to 3-3. And I who knows what will happen this weekend with Georgetown. We're young. You know, I like Torps a lot, and he's grinding. So really happy for him on a human level, and happy for the guys.
The men's and women's NCAA championship weekends are heading back to Gillette Stadium, held jointly for the first time since 2017. From May 23rd to the 26th, there is nowhere in the lacrosse world better off to be than Foxborough, Massachusetts, for 8 of the best and most impactful lacrosse games of the season. The action starts Friday with the women's D1 semifinals, continues Saturday with the men's D1 semis, then championship action starts Sunday with men's Division 2, men's Division 3, and women's D1, culminating Monday afternoon with the men's D1 final. As we get closer, we're going to talk about who we think is actually going to make it there, but in the meantime, this year, Inside Lacrosse is proud to partner with the NCAA to offer you, our loyal listeners, $5 off single-day ticket options for men and women by using the code ILPOD at checkout. So head to ncaa.com/laxtickets and enter ILPOD at checkout to purchase your tickets. You know you're going to be there championship weekend, so why not get $5 off and help us show the NCAA how awesome our loyal listeners are by purchasing your tickets today. Once again, ncaa.com/laxtickets. Nile Pot at checkout for $5 off your tickets. Let's jump into the most high-profile result of the weekend, that coming out of the Carrier Dome. The Orange, coming off of a loss to Maryland last week, got knocked down a peg by virtue of the Terps taking it to them in the second half, but they were taking on a Harvard team that was coming in a little bit reeling with a midweek loss to Colgate. And the Crimson managed to overcome Johnny Mullen's 90% day at the faceoff X, and they did so without an eye-popping day from Sam King. He was held to just 2-1. I think any Harvard fan would have expected that if the Crimson were going to upset the Orange, it was going to be by virtue of a virtuoso day from their talisman. Yet it was Teddy Malone who led the way with 4 goals and an assist, and 8 Crimson players scored. Part of that was aided by a overall 40% day in net from Syracuse goaltenders. Started with Jimmy McCool. He got replaced by Michael Ippoliti. And ultimately, Graham Stevens, Harvard's opposite number in net, was able to make just one more of those necessary saves as the Crimson held the Orange to 14 goals and managed to hold on down the stretch when that game got tight. Larkin, thoughts on this one?
It was stunning. You know, I actually, because of the nature of the way the slate worked, I didn't watch it in real time. And you know, as the statistics came out and as kind of the Twitter machine got rolling around what happened at the Faceoff X, I like found time last night, you know, incremental capacity to go back and watch. I think in terms of like building blocks, everyone thinks Syracuse's offense is really good. So you think about how you need to beat them. And to me, it starts with possessions. So there's this like fundamental disconnect in what we saw on the field yesterday. And just the eye test of when Syracuse is ripping the rock around on O, like they seem scary. And last week, you know, like the postmortem on the trip to Maryland, I kind of left with, well, Maryland's culture and defense and like Tillman and Bernhardt at home. And, you know, to me, I really felt strongly about heading back to the Dome. I actually think very highly of Sam King. Like, I think he's one of the best players in the country that not a lot of people know about just because Harvard hasn't made the Ivy League tournament or the tournament the last few years. So I'm not shocked that they put up 15. I think it's the nature of just at home, possession, majority and not finding a way to win that game. And this is the type of result with how good Cornell and Princeton might be that could really impact Syracuse's RPI and potential seeding. So they get down to some must-win contests here pretty quickly.
So I was covering the Hopkins-Carolina game, which we'll talk about a little later, and like you, wasn't able to watch this one in real time. So I think we've got to go to a Harvard superfan, a 2016 alum, former Crimson attackman Will Walker joins us now. And this is cool, not just because of the context that he can provide on this one, but also apparently you guys know each other. Who knew?
Yeah, just a little bit. Will Walker's the reason I went to Andover, and he's a dear friend of mine. We'll be staying at my wedding someday. So we like each other, even though we wear different hats on this podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Terry. Believe it or not, Larkin, when he was a new sophomore at Andover when we were in high school together, he was a scrawny second-line mid who couldn't shoot the ball head up and just was basically passing skip passes every time he dodged, which was a sight to see. And if you haven't heard this story before, he was complaining late in like a midseason game about how none of our defensemen could go take the ball from someone when we were down. And our coach handed him a deep hole, made him go in and said, "You're never playing short stick again," which was a riot because he actually meant it. And like literally on Monday after the game, Larkin was playing close defense and never looked back. It's a hilarious story though. But yeah, thanks for having me on. Go Blue, by the way. Two Andover boys on the podcast right now is amazing. If we had Luke Dupree, then he would really have the trio, but not sure if that's possible.
I'm going to try to get Bill Belichick for next week. That'll round it out, right?
I think we had Bill at a couple games in high school.
Yeah, we did.
Will say. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So, Will, we can start narrow and get broad, or we can start broad and get narrow. Which would you prefer?
I mean, maybe I guess gut reaction was like you start the game, losing faceoffs, which has been an issue for the program for like 10 years, but also this season has been an issue in the early goings. And then, they moved the ball so well and they were getting to the middle and like it just felt like, whether it was three goals in a row quick, then two others. Maybe we touched the ball once or twice in that period. So you sort of just felt like they were getting theirs. They were zipping the ball around and it was going to be kind of a runaway. I think the huge part was that Stevens in Cage, the freshman who's looked awesome and looked awesome in this game too. He had such a good start first quarter and then was massive in the second quarter as well. So he at least like gave us a chance to get some O looks. And I think the offense is really talented group. Obviously Kemp called out King. I mean, he's as good as anyone in the country. But there's two other great attackmen and a lot of depth at midfield. So if we got to figure out the faceoff X, because to lose 28 times at the X and win the game is like just not sustainable. It doesn't feel like. I thought Stevens kept us in it in the first half, which then I thought cast a little bit of doubt, at least in Cuse's head. You go into the half at 10-7, we score late. King gets one there. Coming down the wing. So it just felt like once we hit the third quarter, it felt like something we could actually pull off despite the X. But was just pumped to see the guys grind it out. I think we beat them on the ground, GBs-wise, by like a dozen GBs, X face-offs. Obviously, we lost every face-off ground ball. But, yeah, I was just pumped with them digging deep and rallying there in the second half.
What was your sense of the relationship between if we just throw the ball at the net, it's going to go in versus getting good looks against the Syracuse defense? What did it feel like as the game wore on?
I can't remember all the goals, but I do feel like we had a lot of piping in. The goalies had a couple maybe soft ones early off dodge, but it did feel like we were shooting well. I think there are generally a lot of good shooters on the offense. King was, game managing, whether he showed up in the stat sheet. I think he had 2-1, but, you felt his presence the whole game. He's drawing a lot of attention. He's getting hockey assists and things like that. But it was really good to see a guy like Malone, who's been, had a great year last year and a good start this year, just like really has an eye for the goal. And I feel like showed that he was not just like a secondary player in this game. I think his shots were good. Perry had a couple big ones that are just unsavable, it felt like. So I kind of felt like we shot well. Goalies obviously didn't steal any, though. So that was a factor. I don't know what you said, maybe 40% save percentage for those guys. So, yeah, it's definitely a flip on the cage between us and them.
And, Will, I want to ask you about the Harvard defense. Obviously, there was the Colgate result, and kind of as we look forward and what can we learn about Syracuse's offense, you know, to me, like when I watch it, I was somewhat surprised by the percent of the possessions late that went through Spallina versus like attack the shorties and spin it. But first, your foundational gut on a Harvard's poles, Harvard scheme, you know, where they stand.
Yeah, I mean, I think they were going to the poles to some extent because you're a Connecticut boy. The guy, Owen Guest, who's I think either a sophomore or a junior, he's a great cover guy as a short stick. And then Dearth is a good cover guy too. So that duo is actually really strong, I think, rope-wise. I just remember feeling in the second half that people couldn't get anywhere on those two. And that just sort of like stymied the offense a little bit. Early on, they were getting to the middle and moving the ball. I mean, they moved the ball super well. Our defense, I feel like, you know, obviously the Tuesday result with Colgate was not a pretty result for the defense. And the first half, certainly the first quarter, you know, we were sort of reeling on defense. I thought a lot of it was like we were sliding quick and they like to move the ball. So off ball feels like maybe where we're getting lost a bit if we're giving up goals. But I thought the second half, I mean, how many shots on goal we gave up? It was like 5 to 10 shots on goal maybe, which was wild. So I actually feel like they kind of bared down late and they just maybe no one was noticeable, but maybe that's a good thing. I think Nelson did a good job on Spallina there in the second half. And he had the nugget to win the game, basically, and he soaked the shot at the end as well. So the big tall guy, 46, I feel like he's, you know, he's quiet type of play, but he seemed to be good. And I'll butcher the last name, but Juiced, who's I think a sophomore, he's going to be a good player, I think. And I think he was covering Hiltz, who obviously had like an incredible game, but he's a great player. Look, I think if I were to summarize. The short stick seems like a good position for us, and we just sort of got to figure out the team defense side of things on the pole. I don't think we have like a master cover guy, but that doesn't mean necessarily we can't play defense going down the stretch, especially with a good goalie.
Yeah, because it makes me, like, looking forward to the league schedule, cursed is a problem. And I think about it all the time, obviously, with the amount of gimmick we need to run at Brown. But, you know, I think that makes a ton of sense. Shout out to number 3, huge soak. I think there was like 4 minutes left, maybe Q's down 1, massive soak. And then one thing just to call out, Terry, because Will and I were texting about this late last night, the penalty on the cross check on the short stick, 2 minutes locked in, just the definition of lacrosse refs inserting themselves into a man's game. Like, there is no world in which that should be a 2 minute lock in.
Well, and I think it really does call into question or notion the Dome Gods, right? And so, you know, Jerry's comment was, in order to win a game in the Carrier Dome by one, you got to win by 3. Will, what was the last like minute like, just in terms of like the white knuckle holding on?
Yeah, I mean, it was wild. I feel like we were up 15-13, I think, with like 4 minutes to go. I think that's when what Larkin was talking about. I think Logan Ipp basically like reached out and took one in the arm or something like that, blocking a shot, which was awesome. We had a couple clears that just went awry, it felt like. I mean, it's tough. Pohl gets on the doorstep. Like, he's probably shooting. You know, we had a save from Cuse on that. I think you probably have to shoot that. We had the behind the back from the Pohl also on the doorstep. And then we had the odd shot. I don't know what happened on the – it wasn't even a 10-man ride. We just fired one in on the goalie with, like, 3 minutes left. So it was nerve-wracking just in terms of, like, a couple of the clearing blenders that we had. But, look, I actually felt good other than, you know, that flag comes in and you're like, okay – they go to review, and so you'd think with the review, then you're like, okay, we're good here. There's no chance that this will be a penalty probably just because he got him up high and a little late. But, I mean, there's no chance it's like more than a minute or locked in. And then, of course, it's 2 minute locked in. Jerry seemed to keep his composure on the sideline from what I saw on the camera. I have no idea. I wasn't on site, but yeah. Then I actually assumed we were losing 16-15 because can't win a draw. They've got an awesome man up. Even though the goalie was playing well, it was like, all right, you need a miracle at this point. Just that was the rest of the game. So super stressed on that front. But, the nugget from Martin Nelson was an epic play because I think that was maybe Hiltz throwing it back across the body. like the start of that final possession where they had one goal lead. So yeah, it was super nerve wracking. But the alumni threads were buzzing. I mean, people were jacked up about the win because you know you lose that game to Colgate, who seemingly looks better than you know we would have thought. But still, you know, you lose this game, you're 1-2. That was one of your big out of conference games. Like now, at least you can like look forward to the season and say like you know there's a lot of different scenarios that could end up playing out. I think Cuse will be great down the stretch. So, but yeah, a lot of cheers and a ton of buzz on the threads after the game ended. So,
what's the vibe check overall? Like as you kind of like I said, we kind of started narrow on the game and now going more, a little bit broader on the program and the outlook for the season.
Yeah, I mean, I think pumped that Jerry's there, and I think he's doing a great job. I know, like. You know, all the results over the years so far haven't been exactly what we'd hoped. I think we got to the tournament faster than we thought we would with like a young team, which was cool. We had a lot of buzz around that, you know, going to Rutgers and for that Princeton win for however many years ago that was. And then I feel like last year we were sort of banged up. So, you know, you didn't have Perry and Gaffney. You had a lot of young midfielders. King was obviously great. But it just sort of felt like last year we had a tough roll of the dice and we really lost like all of the really hard games. We lost by like 3 or 4 goals. So we still, I thought like hung in there. So coming into this year, like a lot of high expectations, I think from the group internally and then also like the alumni, cause you got, you know, Perry and Gaffney back. A lot of those younger guys got a lot better last year cause they had to play. So the midfield depth looks good. The attack line, I think is going to be great this year. So to lose to Colgate, I think, was super deflating because, you know, we felt like, okay, first game you beat Providence. They seem to have a little pop this year. There's a little buzz around them. And so we felt, okay, 12-10, you know, first game of the season, like good to get that win. Losing to Colgate in that fashion, I felt like was daunting because you're just like, okay, what's wrong with the defense here? Just giving up that many goals. But look, I think they just beat up on Nova, which makes you feel a little better. And then the way we responded after losing that game to go on the road up into the dome for these guys, I think people are pumped. The way we're viewing it, I think, is like you've got, I think, a really strong offense. You've got problems at the X, at least it seems, and you've got a really good goalie. And then the defense is just going to have to get better every week. But people are optimistic, I think, now, certainly coming off this Cuse game.
Yeah, the part that's – so it's a huge win for Jerry. And just to give him some flowers, I mean, going to the Dome, like first ACC win since 2016, I don't think anyone in the world, especially considering Cuse lost last week, so like they kind of got the stub the toe, and I'm sure they were circling the wagons all week up in upstate. I mean, it's a massive win. The part that's been fascinating to me just through like the Burn evolution, bad luck starting during COVID, actually a huge pull in flipping King from Denver. I'm sure Billy T is still mad about that. Like he's a – incredible X player. We haven't had one since 2016. The part that's just been really fascinating from an outsider's perspective is like, you know, I'm a laxer and I talk to a lot of defensive guys. He's universally respected as like one of the best defensive minds of all time. Eddie Glazner, Landis, whoever. It's more just curious that like for whatever reason, it seemingly hasn't snapped on the back end. And it's scary actually as a Brown alum because like if and when they do get the back end rolling and get a clamper, that's like the upside case. I will say, I think I'm not trying to speak for Will, but it is what's going on in Ithaca right now is not good. And I know that, I look at Harvard as like a top 10 job in the country, arguably. Like, I think they should have sky high expectations. I think they get really, really high quality players. So it'll just be interesting to see how it all plays out. Like, it's the type of team you don't really want to like ride or fade every week. Cause you just don't really, they can beat anybody. And that's a good thing.
All right, well, I got one more for you, and then we can get you out of here. So, you know, I don't know that this is necessarily causal, but let's call it correlating. I've seen a rise in, you know, kind of the energy and attention around meme coin, and it's corresponded with the prevalence of the 10-man ride. And so now with Argentina president Javier Milei basically getting into a scandal with Libra a couple weeks ago, and now he's been sued more than 100 times, really alienated his base, and you know, there's impeachment conversations in Argentina. I'm wondering whether or not you're in favor of outlawing the ability to back up a shot that's taken from your own half of the field, or if you're in favor of rug pulling the effective 10-man ride that put the defense, the clearing team, in a position where they have to resort to what is an otherwise bullshit attempt to clear the ball?
I actually think I could be wrong on this, but I think Tills may have like been the first guy to start firing the ball at the net in the 10-man when he was coaching at Harvard. My brother was there at the time, and you didn't
really
see
his 10-man. That was the
possession shot. Yeah, so, and that was his whole thing. But the problem was none of the refs were used to that. So I'd be at all the Harvard games. Tills was, every time the 10-man ride, he was firing it down the field, and the refs would have it going the other way, and he'd be rip shit on the sideline. It was incredible. And so he'd have to, I think, meet with, again, I'm speaking for him, but my brother was on the team at the time. I think he was like meeting with the refs before the game saying, hey, look, if there's a 10-man, we're shooting. So just as an FYI, I think you have to allow it, even though it's a pain, because otherwise I think it's just too tough to beat the 10-man without having at least that option. So yeah, I guess I'm long shot, just in terms of facing the 10-man.
Larkin, what was the longest goal of your career?
That's a good question.
Did you have one of those, like 65-yarders?
Yeah, it wasn't. So I think I had a couple when we would go into Ratty. Like, say 2 minutes, you're up by two, and they're in double down. And I would go, like, stand near the midfield line, and they would go try and double dill. I think I had a couple from about 50, but I never had a, you know, in the clear, I was always deep, so I was never, like, the low man. Tullett, I think, had a couple. Jack Kelly scored. But the other thing, just to comment on it, that I'm actually pro, as a defensive coordinator, you have to think about whether you want to send your cover guy up to the midfield line in the 10-man, because when they shoot it over the net, then you have, like, Sam King picking it up going on your number two.
That's actually been my
a level of complexity.
That's been my favorite counter strategy, that of effectively the riding team, the 10-man riding team, that then just backs up the shot, right, by virtue of staying lower than the lowest clearing man. And I think that is potentially a mitigating presence that I would like to see kind of rise in prominence strategically.
I think you could also consider, you know, taking like your inside guy, firing him out front, and you start firing at the goal a little lower and see if you can get maybe a quick dunk. I haven't seen anyone try to do that. Yeah, exactly. I haven't seen anyone try to do that.
Well, after our tactical talk last week, I had three coordinators in my texts on Monday. So we'll see. I'll let you guys know if there's any thoughts on how to beat the 10-man or how to adjudicate the 10-man, because I just think that what is given as a shot right now is a very liberal interpretation of a shot by most of these officials. And I am, for as much as I'm in favor of not allowing a shot taken in your own defensive half of the field to be backed up, I am equally as opposed to trying to define the parameters of a shot. Like, it has to go within the whatever, like the goalposts, as long as it's like asking a ref to do that is insanity. So just please don't let that be the outcome, which there's like a, you know, a 33% voting block of NCAA coaches who think that that's a good idea. They're the same ones that created the crease within the crease, and they can all go, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I don't think you can pull that off.
Will, you're the man. Thank you so much for joining us. Congrats to the Crimson. Good luck the rest of the way. I'm allowed to say it. Larkin probably isn't, but we really appreciate the time.
Yeah, no doubt. See you, fellas.
All right, Larkin, you mentioned that was only the beginning of what was otherwise a great slate of college lacrosse. We're going to go to Columbus, Ohio next. This was a straight-up whooping. Like, I don't know if Ohio State actually just ran out their football team, but they certainly out-physicaled the Cavaliers all over the field. In terms of so the final was 14-5, Buckeyes over Virginia. And in terms of offensive production for Lars Tiffany's team, Ryan Colsey had 4-1. Truett Sunderland had 3 assists. Griffin Schutz had a goal. That is it. Meanwhile, the Buckeyes were led by Shane O'Leary and Griffin Turner, who had 4 points each. And Virginia had the faceoff advantage, but again, continued to struggle in net, playing both guys. Caleb Fayok, meanwhile, stopped 71% for the Buckeyes. One of the important details of this, and this is going to be something I'll get to in a second, but half of their 14 goals were assisted. What was your take?
Stunned. This was by far the most shocking result of the weekend. I also think that to the casual observer that sees Ohio State now at 5-1, they may think that like Nick Myers and crew have like, you know, basically had a huge come to Jesus after the Utah loss and have been kind of trending along, like clipping Big Ten teams. just to read for everyone, they've beaten Detroit Mercy, Cleveland State, Bellarmine, and Air Force. Like, I don't know if we've learned anything about Ohio State heading into yesterday. Obviously, they have athletes, you know, in particular, they have a cover guy. So when you think about the Millen matchup, you know, there may have been some thesis around, hey, Virginia's going to need complementary scoring. But it's alarming. I mean, and remember, you know, I consider Lars a friend, and he gave me my opportunity to go to college, so I don't mean to rag on it. But it's a school that should never, ever struggle to generate leverage, specifically dodging on short sticks. I mean, there are just five-star athletes up and down the bench. Like, you could quite literally just point to a random guy who's playing defensive midfield at Virginia, and he would be like the highest-ranked recruit in the history of Brown's offensive midfield, Hudson Hausman, as an example. So it's stunning. It's stunning when your ex-attackman's bageled. It's absolutely stunning that there were no answers. I actually was just surprised by the lack of fight, like irrelevant to outcome. It felt like if you just turn on the third quarter film, and that's like a John Tortorella coach hockey team, there would just be guys like metaphorically punching and on their toes coming out in the second half. And if you happen to go down to a hot goalie, you go down to a hot goalie. So it is a lot of questions are going to be asked. Questions are going to be asked about Kerwin leaving and Cassis. Questions are going to be asked about how good Schellenberger was with Cormier and whether, you know, they've covered up perhaps a lot of like scheme deficiency. And I'll say this just to play the other side of the coin. Like Lars, many people stumble into ACC head coaching jobs in different ways. Like Lars was a grinder with really poor players, like having to find a way to go beat the Harvards on the road. He's not uncomfortable needing to gimmick and scheme and adjust. Like, he makes midseason adjustments. So I don't know if I'm going to be taking the other side of the Virginia bet, but it's certainly shocking. And it is probably as rattled as that alumni base and fan group's been since Starge left.
So it's obvious that you can't win a game by scoring 5 goals. And I think that any analysis of the game deserves to start there. But when you look at where Ohio State's strengths were, not just coming into this game, but really over the course of the last several years, really in the post-Jack Myers era, to allow 14 is equally alarming. And, you know, allowing 14 to Ohio State is akin to allowing 20 to, you know, a lot of the other teams that are going to be on your schedule. And you pointed to the third quarter, and that was where Patrick McEwen directed my attention. And he just, you know, kept like giving these examples of naked backside shooters and the inability for a second slide to be coordinated. And it was really compelling, right? It's a very good case for exactly some of the issues that emerged with the Virginia defense. And so, you know, I think that it's interesting because there are a lot of teams that came into this season with high expectations that have suffered early season setbacks and are looking for answers to questions that they didn't expect to have to answer. And I think that there's this dichotomy between we've got one fire that we know we have to put out, and once we put that out, everything else is going to kind of fall into place, versus we've got fires everywhere and we don't know how to prioritize what we need to put out. And sometimes that is actually masked as an overall 10 to 20% increase in buy-in and accountability. And you and I are not in these locker rooms, and so we would be doing our listeners a disservice if we were trying to speculate what's going on in those locker rooms. But as a player, I'm sure you've been on teams where the issue was we have this one deficiency. We can't win faceoffs. We can't make saves, whatever. And either we need to mask that and overcome it, or we need to find incremental growth and improvement there. And once we do, the compounding effect on the rest of the field is going to be felt. Versus, I'm sure you've also been in locker rooms where it was like, our problem is that none of us are doing things as well as we can or need to. And so we all need to increase our buy-in. And once we do that, then an across the board 20% increase in accountability is going to be the thing that answers. How do you differentiate those two experiences in terms of what's easier to fix? What's a better problem to have if you're kind of back against the wall? It's February 23rd and you're like, where do we go from here?
It's tough, and it's so complicated because of where in the, like, I guarantee what Lars is struggling with, like what's keeping him up at night, is that he has a once every 10-year quality pull. So his head is telling him to speed it up, like to create chaos. But the reality is he has two sides of the ball that are like below index, let's call it, in the ACC. Like his off-ball D is struggling. He's not generating any productive looks, and his like offensive efficiency is well below where it should be. So actually, you may need to like slow the thing down. Like, you may need to try and beat Hopkins, like, 7-6, irrelevant to clamp advantage or middle of the field, quote unquote, ground ball advantage. You know, the good news is, like, I think the keepers are better. You know, everyone's going to talk about the keepers. I think they'll be fine. It's very hard to coach off ball defense midseason. Like, when you're so athletic, that, you know, the Cole Kastner's, who's now playing basketball at Stanford, by the way, like, I see him on campus. You know, ultimately, like, when Lars left Brown, he no longer needed to coach high field defense the way you have to at Brown, where, like, you cannot play if you don't know how to two slide, because we have to two slide to every single Dodger on Cornell, right? And, you know, you don't need to do that at Virginia. And it's really hard to teach that mid-year because people are kind of used to the nature of, like, island help, or at least adjacent help, everywhere except to X. So I think offensively is where I would look for short-term fixes. I would actually potentially see personnel and or scheme adjustments. And I think they're going to get, like, hyper-granular about attacking short six and just trying to create matchup advantages. But it's tough. It's really hard anytime you have two sides of the ball that are both a problem.
So you made the point that I want to follow up on about having a generational pull that makes you feel like you want to go faster and take advantage of early offensive opportunities. And this is going to sound like a criticism of Ben Ware's game, and maybe it is, but I think you're uniquely positioned to speak about this, which is, if you're a defender who is very offensive-oriented, a lot of defensive purists, the Bill Tierneys of the world, will say something along the lines of, I like my defender to play defense. How do you square that criticism?
I think it's totally valid. So, like, my game is very misunderstood by people who don't watch film. Like, basically, I started scoring as a sophomore, and then people assumed I could cover. It really wasn't the case. Like, if Lars was on here, he would tell you that I was just a really good off-ball defender. Like, I took a ton of pride in knockdowns. I treated it incredibly seriously in terms of, like, helping shorties and being in the right place with my feet. There are so few Michael Earharts, like, roaming this planet. Ultimately, Ben Ware's job is, if you just took the pole away, right, and he didn't play any O at all, like, his literal job is just to support short sticks and make it extremely challenging, specifically front end of clock, to generate leverage and spin the ball through X. Like, quite literally just slow the game down, support the shorties, force the offense to look elsewhere for matchup advantages, and kind of play that 3v3 push-pull and, like, do your job in that triangle. So I think it's totally fair, and I think that he's going to have to double down on defensive principles, and ultimately the offense will come. He's so athletic. He's got an absolute hammer. Goalies don't know where it's going because I don't think he knows where it's going, which is actually a huge advantage. It's highly deceptive. So those points will come, and especially the way, you know, Lars lets him stay on all those things. I am so blessed that, like, John Yazzo is one of my best friends, right? So it was very natural for me to understand what he was thinking and to support him in ways, because that's just, like, what we do. We support each other at the bar on the weekends. Like, we hang out. I think Ware's got to start, like, attaching himself at the hip to his short sticks. I know a few of them are young. And find a way, especially if they're going to bring him the ball on picks, to just really lock that down and get them out of whatever they're trying to do.
I think this is kind of a natural segue into what I want to talk about with the next game, which was North Carolina 13, Johns Hopkins 12. The Heels jumped out to a 3-0 lead in the first 57 seconds and answered every single time Hopkins made a run. The fourth and final time came with about 10 minutes to go in the fourth quarter when Hopkins took their first lead of the game, and Carolina responded with three goals in about 90 seconds. And then that put them up 13-11, and they basically held on the rest of the stretch. Talking about long pole goals, Quinton Kellerin cut it to one with about 2 minutes left, and ultimately a Russ Melendez shot got eaten up by a Mike Gianforcaro save that was, you know, otherwise a relatively rough day for the Princeton grad transfer. Obviously, a huge part of that start was Brady Wambach kind of flying out of the gate, but ultimately Logan Callahan responded with a really nice save at the faceoff X. Luke Stout made one save in the first quarter while Gianforcaro made three, but he finished up with 10. So ultimately, the Blue Jays ended up with advantages in both specialty positions, but it was just a virtuoso performance from Don Petromala, who had six goals, and Owen Duffy, who had 4-1, that led the Tar Heels to a win for a very familiar Petromala group on Homewood.
Yeah, that's well said. Let me just start with the emotion of the Petro thing. I actually think that COVID has, like, really complicated people's understanding of the back end of the Petro years. Like, the end of Petromala on Homewood was Final Four, first round, quarterfinals, first round. Like, it wasn't as bad, I think, as the casual lacrosse fan thinks now. The only reason I bring that up is, like, as a Nebraska football fan, when we fired Solich and post-Osborne, like, the classic be careful what you wish for. If you don't think Don Petromala, it's so rare in life that you get to have your dad's back. Like, someone who grew up idolizing the guys like Kyle Harrison and Paul Rabil and grew up on Homewood and always wanted to wear that color and score for his dad at the Final Four. Like, I can't even imagine the juice in the building when those balls were going in. So just as a human being, I think it's really cool. And I'm really happy for that family and for Carolina. Like, you know, and we all know Brashfield on the hot seat. I'm happy for their start. I like John Thompson. So I think it's cool that Carolina's hot. And I actually just thought the game was a great lacrosse game. I think that tactically, Dom, you know, the nation understanding how he can shoot does so much for Owen Duffy and creates kind of complications in how you guard them, similar to kind of what Schellenberger and Cormier had for so long, or, you know, Duke with Dyson Williams. And, you know, there's all sorts of examples. I'm sure the Cuse fans want me to say that Spallina and Hiltz. But that's really the makeup of great offensive efficiency, is kind of having that off-ball threat. But I just thought it was a great day for lacrosse, and I think those little storylines are the best.
Yeah, and you're right. I think there's an argument that it's been the best game of the season so far. It didn't necessarily have the, you know, dozen lead changes that sometimes we correspond to that claim, but it was really riveting. The thing I want to talk about is just that the Blue Jays' defensive approach is so unique, and there is DNA, shared DNA. Pete Milliman talked about this on a podcast this week with Jesse Schwartzman, and basically, the way I conceive of Dave Petromala's defense is, you know, it was slide and recover in the Bill Tierney lineage, but also very faithful to your primary matchup. And so Michael Evans was the platonic ideal of a Johns Hopkins defenseman, where it was, I am not going to get beat. You're going to sub me off on the clear because I literally cannot catch. But I am going to give up maybe one goal this season where somebody takes advantage of me athletically. So to watch this Johns Hopkins defense be so slide to everything oriented that it could almost feel like a zone, and then in so doing, A, be very matchup unconscious, which is kind of the Jerry Byrne principle, and B, just be moving so frequently. It is what it is. I'm not out of the gates opposed to the approach or the strategy, and perhaps because I'm a you know, if I were building a team and I would adjust based on my personnel, but generally speaking, I'd rather get stops by causing turnovers than, you know, relying on my goalie to make saves or you know, trying to wear the offense down and wait for him to throw the ball out of bounds. I'd rather be active going out and approaching. I do think that, you know, being a very frenetic slide team is more conducive to taking the ball away as opposed to sliding less. But with that being said, against this particular offense where the personnel is so oriented around two guys, one of whom is a time and route shooter and the other is exceptionally good at attacking closeouts and attacking bad approaches, it really felt like Hopkins' defense was giving offense to Carolina. And the number of times that Owen Duffy ran through two poles that were both approaching him, and then the number of times that Don Petromala caught the ball with about 5 yards of space felt preventable. And it felt like, had the approach been, we're not going to slide from Petromala, and so as a result, he was constantly being guarded, and we're going to be very faithful with trying to keep Scott Smith on Owen Duffy, I don't know that it prevents Carolina from getting to 10, but I do think it prevents them from getting to 13, and that's kind of the difference in the game.
I think that's totally, totally fair, rational. I think the increase in slide happiness comes from basically probability math around shot clock. So, like, people have realized that if you tell your defensive midfielders to kind of be on their toes, not their heels, and slide to the first two dodges, let's call it, right? Well, you're now 25 seconds into the clock, and, you know, tick by tick, the efficiency of the defensive rating goes up. It puts a remarkable amount of pressure on your backside. You need guys who can knock it down. You need guys who can pick the right push-pull matchup of understanding, hey, this week they're going to be kind of looking at this skip lane versus that. And another thing to call out is this is Johns Hopkins, right? 10-6 gets you fired at Johns Hopkins, or it did, as we just talked about. Beating four teams in May who have the quality of ball carrier and decision-making of an Owen Duffy is very, very hard to do with slide-happy, switch-happy, come-off-the-pipes-happy defensive philosophy. And you nailed it. Like, the Tierney burn, not really care about matchups, that's actually very structurally different than, like, hey, no matter where they set this pick, like, we're coming off of it, and we're going to just, like, basically create adjacent rotations without really having to earn it. So I think it's a wait and see. Like, I give Hopkins credit in that they're 4-1. They've had a really challenging schedule. They obviously deserve the benefit of the doubt currently. But there have been very few teams with that level of athlete that have played this structure and gone to Memorial Day. So I think it's a good call out. And you know, if you're a Hopkins fan, I think the areas to draw your eyes to is like the backside help and to make decisions on whether you trust those two guys on an island come Memorial Day with like three Maryland shooters, you know, knocking it down, doing what they need to do.
How similar is a slide to everything defense to a zone defense in your opinion?
It's a good question. I think the key difference is actually it's the offensive structure. So on a net basis, like the actual reaction of the defensive players isn't that different, but what you'll see in man, slide happy man, is the nature of how the poles slide is very organic and natural in that, okay, we got the big righty coming down the alley. We're going to slide hard to him, bumper cover. Okay, now we're getting ready for the lefty. Like it, so it almost works like, you know, pistons in an engine in that both your defensive midfielders and your pipes can feel very comfortable in, hey, you know, we're playing Princeton. They're running high pairs. This is where the slide's going to come from. This is how we're going to have to recover. I think where zone gets a little more complicated is like you kind of have like heavy action wheels on either side. And depending on who you're playing, the nature of how you slide can be very different. So I do think there's a delta there. But the biggest reason to say, hey, we're just going to go is you got young kids or athletes that you'd prefer to be on your toes, not your heels. And you'd rather live and die by the pole on a double team with an opportunity to take the ball away versus like reactionary getting caught in no man's land. And that, honestly, like, if I was coaching a Patriot League team, a CAA team, an Ivy League team, I'd be slide happy. I'd recruit smart kids, find two defensive midfielders who understand what we're trying to do. The issue is, like, this is Johns Hopkins. If you lose to Syracuse and UNC and whoever every year, but beat everybody else, like, you lose your job over time. So I think it's something to monitor and watch.
This podcast, if it has a single theme to this point, has been talking about teams who are figuring out who they are. So let's talk about a team that knows exactly who they are or who it is, and that is the Maryland Terrapins, who beat Princeton 13-9 on Class of 1952 Stadium on Saturday. Tigers got out to a 3-1 lead, but went cold in the second when the Terps went on a 6-0 run that featured six different scorers. Logan McNaney led in Princeton's first three shots, but finished 60% for the day. Five Terps finished with two goals, including Jack Schultz, who scored the first goal of his career, as did, I believe, Aiden Aiken. The Terps are number two, and they are taking on number one in Atlanta at Georgia Tech on Saturday, a game that I'll be in attendance for. What do you got to say about this one?
Terps are a wagon. Like, Tills and the fellas. It honestly, like, it never ceases to amaze me. If you peel back the data, like, if I told Madelon heading in that his offense would turn the rock over six times, they'd go 19 of 20 on clears, right? The faceoff delta wouldn't be that big. You know, they didn't foul. Maryland had no extra mans. Like, there's a lot of kind of pillars of success there. So, you know, to me, these are two great teams. People are very, very high on Princeton. The rumblings in the Ivy are very high on Princeton. So this was a kind of a wait and see. I was interested, especially coming off the Cuse win, just the humanity of it. Hey, you know, we're riding high, we're feeling good. I don't think people really realize, like, I couldn't even name a guy on Princeton's offense 2 months ago. Or sorry, Maryland's. Like, it's truly getting to the point where Maryland is facelessly dominant in that every year, like, different guys are just rolling out of bed and getting them to a place where they're kind of Final Four quality. And I think we're going to learn a lot this weekend, both with Notre Dame, you know, not, and this is an unfair shot to Georgetown. I don't mean it this way, but you know, it's early season. They start a little later. They've played less games. You could argue they're less kind of like fine tuned, let's call it, than perhaps Maryland. So I'm very curious, as we think about Notre Dame's odds rolling into the three-peat of, you know, what this outcome looks like and just the eye test.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I'm excited because I've always felt like Bobby Dodd Stadium was going to be a perfect venue for lacrosse. So the fact that there actually is a game being played there and that they're intentionally keeping the GT at center field or midfield just to make sure that everybody knows exactly where it is, but they're scrubbing all the football lines otherwise off of it is an incredible detail that Jason Breo, the guy who's putting on the game, deserves all that credit for. But with that being said, you know, you kind of teed me up perfectly for the thing that I wanted to talk about in the wake of this game, which is after Syracuse, this storyline or narrative emerged about the acknowledgement within the team that they didn't have any preseason All-Americans. And this is not an uncommon thing in the history of the John Tillman era. I was the guy that earlier in my career did a lot of like the player ranking stuff. And I remember, you know, we would have our freshman rankings and then we'd have the Tort and watch. And then you'd want to fill it out like a third or fourth week. And so we would do like, you know, the top attackman, top midfielder, just whatever. And I remember I did that. I did like the top five or 10 at each position and Maryland didn't have a single one, but I didn't include goalies. And so then the following week, I did like the top long stick, the top faceoff guy, the top maybe short stick, and then the top goalie. And Maryland was number one in each of them because it was like Charlie Raffa, Jared Bernhardt, or Jesse Bernhardt, Nico Amato was the goalie at the time. And so the point was like, you know, yeah, like that team wasn't stocked. And I think Chanchuk was probably young and Brian Cole and whatever. There were like a lot of really good players, but they weren't necessarily like at the top of their position. And I think that's essentially what you're looking at with this group. Like, you know, I think if you were doing voting now, like Jack McDonald probably deserves some attention for those types of conversations. He's played two games. He missed their first three games, right? Logan McNaney is a most outstanding player in an NCAA tournament and absolutely deserves preseason All-American consideration, and he got it, but he finished like 32nd in save percentage in the country last year. So the point is that like, how are you at, like there's this marriage of objective evaluation with reasonable expectations for what you're going to see because it's Maryland, and it creates a lot of tension. And the other side of the coin too is that like, you know, for as impressive as making the national championship game was last season, they also did lose in the first round to Army 2 years ago. So it's not as if there's an inevitability or an invincibility. It is that there is a consistent overperformance relative to the index. And, you know, this is one of those up years. But again, it's not infallible. So I think your points are well taken with respect to who Maryland is and what this game shows us, and specifically in conjunction with the season to date and the Syracuse game. But also at the same time, there's a lot to be learned both about how, you know, Maryland measures up against Notre Dame, and then certainly as how Notre Dame measures up against Maryland.
And one more thing to call out just to kind of frame it for everyone. The other thing is they've had coordinator turnover. Like you look at John Donowski's staff in Durham and he's had, you know, Caputo and his son for like 15 plus years or whatever it is. You look at the old Desco staffs at Cuse. You look at, you know, some of the great coaching continuity across all sports. It's very rare that you get like a Nick Saban type where his defensive coordinator becomes like his rival school's head coach every 2 years because they're trying to beat him. And, you know, the new sexy thing to do over the last decade has just been to go and interview Tillman's coordinators, and they've gotten all sorts of jobs and spread their wings. And so just, again, to pump his tires and keep in the culture and kind of the continuity of, you know, just every year they have like a Schmeister quality defenseman and, you know, some kid I've never heard of is going to play like really efficient offense. And, you know, it's just remarkable.
You mentioned it, but Notre Dame avoided the upset that was the most listened to podcast of this series last year when Nick Osella watched his team fall to the Georgetown Hoyas. And they advanced to 3-0 in D.C. Cornell took care of Denver 15-5 to get the day started with a 11:30 opening whistle. Duke had to score the last two goals of regulation and then in overtime in order to beat Michigan. Can't recall whether that final was 8-7 or 7-6. Apologies. Colgate took care of business against Villanova. We've already heard from Mr. Walker that folks might be pretty high on the Raiders, and they certainly seem to have improved relative to that 19-9 loss at Virginia that followed on the heels of an opening season loss to Penn State. What was your take on that quartet of games? What's it tell you about the ecosystem?
So I don't think we learned much during Notre Dame Georgetown. I think Georgetown's in that second tier of, like, you know, hoping to make the tournament and find a way to knock two teams off. I think everyone knows Notre Dame, not just because they're the defending champs, but because of the eye test and the product. Like, they're obviously in that kind of AAA rating. Two quick points. I don't think Denver stinks. I think Denver's extremely well coached. I don't think they have a Westberg type, you know, ball carrier. So I don't think they're, like, elite. But that is a really quality result for Cornell. And this is a hockey-specific reference, but Busick is giving me a little bit of Rob Brind'Amour vibes in that because he's young, fit, and was a world-class player when he retired and became the head coach of Cornell, there's just a level of swagger that, like, he can bring into the room. Like, if he tells you to get downhill in the right-handed alley and he says he can do it better than you, he literally means it. Like, not as in he could – like, Gary Gate could do it 20 years ago. Like, Busick could do it tomorrow. And I think that they are – and this sucks to admit, obviously, because, you know, I take a lot of pride in some of our results against Cornell, and I used to, you know, consider us right there with them. But they have really elevated to a point where I do believe they belong in that category currently with Notre Dame and Maryland. Like, I put them in that AAA. I put everyone else a step below. And then the rest of the results, I was really unimpressed with Duke on film. You know, the Colgate thing, let's just use it as, like, a vehicle to describe something. I think the Tier 2-3 has never been muddier. And people call out parity. I almost just think it might be that a lot of teams are pretty mediocre right now, you know, and that's kind of, you point to the Virginias and the Dukes and maybe even Cuse, like, if you want to chirp them for losing in the dome to Harvard, who I think's, you know, good, not great. I think we have a pack of 25 teams that on any given Saturday, like, the bottom of that pack could beat the top. And that 25 group is, like, a massive gap below the AAA that I called out.
And that's the way that it's supposed to be. And I think that the extent to which it, you know, is different or changed, I mean, it's just, in my opinion, and it's tough because I might have been a little, like, underreactive to it in the moment. But now looking at it in reverse, the double graduation year and the presence of, you know, the fifth years over the course of the last 2 to 3 seasons, because in 2022, it was not so injurious to the team that didn't have them. We saw 6 Ivy League teams that didn't have, I mean, they had fifth years in the sense that some of them had withdrawn. But generally speaking, you know, they weren't on advantaged footing relative to the rest of their peers. And in some instances, they were significantly disadvantaged because they hadn't brought in transfers. It proved not to be the difference. It wasn't the reason that they fell short. So I think I overemphasized that data point and used it to underemphasize the role that it played in determining who the best teams were in 2023 and 24. And now that it's gone, I think that, you know, I'm trying to appropriately react to its impact as far as who's good this year and why there, it seems like there's so much volatility on year-over-year results with respect to who was good at the end of 2024.
I think that makes a ton of sense, and I've been kind of harping on that point, and I was waiting for it to play out. I was hopeful, let's call it, because obviously I support a team that's in that second tier of the pack, let's call it. But it makes a ton of sense, right? Like, this is not a shot at Notre Dame. They deserve those titles. But, like, Brian Tevlin was one of the best players, you know, Devin McClain. Like, they've had Chris Fake. And that's just one team. You know, all the top 10, you know, the Big Ten and the ACC have, you know, benefited from the riches of the COVID displacement. And that coming to an end, I think, will be a lot easier for people to, like, understand where teams sit and, you know, more be able to just judge it based on, like, NIL and recruiting. So I'm with you.
Larkin, there is a lot more action that we could have talked about, but really appreciate your time. Enjoyed the conversation as always. Tremendous insight in a lot of areas, and very much looking forward to the feedback from the listeners of this one. If you like what you heard, tell a friend, leave a rating and review. If you shout Larkin out in your 5-star review for the Inside Lacrosse podcast, I will do something nice for Brown Lacrosse and the Kemp Report this week. And we will be back next week with more Inside Lacrosse podcast, more of the tailgate, and hopefully Nick is going to have an incredible story for us. In the meantime, for your benefit, go Bears.
Appreciate it, man. Something tells me Nick's not catching anything, shooting anything, I should say. But have fun. Talk soon.